Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Marty Ruby, and I am an alcoholic. And what a treat to be here with y'all at Girl Stock International. And I love that it's a journey through the steps. And I love that each and every one of the speakers is going through the steps. And we have an Al-Anon. And that we take a journey through the weekend. She covered all 12. We journey through the weekend, and the steps that I've taken throughout my recovery has been a journey through my life. And it's what I find fascinating is what it looked like 27 years ago and how it has progressed through those years. My sobriety date is October 19th, 1989, and I am as grateful as I know how to be about that. Thank you. I got myself a home group. It's called the Buda Big Book Group because I'm from Buda, Texas. And shout out to Buda Big Book Group. They were here earlier. I think they went to go get a massage or something like that. There they are. There they are. Hey. We have a big book study meeting on Sunday nights at 7 o'clock. Come on down. Give me a call. We'll meet you up there. I have a sponsor. Who has a sponsor? And I want to thank Polly, and I want to thank Amanda. How much fun is it to get into the room with Amanda? And I think the funnest part is when Amanda starts to laugh before she tells the joke. Oh, my gosh. Thank you to Rena for introducing me and hosting me. And I want to thank all of you women who have took the time, who have taken the time and the effort and the expense to be here this weekend. And it's a big deal. And what if you were standing where I'm standing and looking out? It's just like it's pretty breathtaking. I just have to tell you. And so give yourself a hand for taking the time out of your life. So. We talk about this, I'm just saying, right? I'm just saying. You came here, and I'm just saying. So what I love about that saying is you can use it for anything. I mean, you can say, well, darling, I know your marriage is falling apart, and he really is just a bad, bad idea. I'm just saying. You know, or my husband can leave the coffee all over the counter like he likes to do, and I can say, I don't know why you don't want to wipe that up every morning. I'm just saying. You know, it's got a million and one uses, you know? We rode down with on the elevator on the way here this afternoon, and by golly, there was some cleavage on that elevator. Fortunately, I was on the elevator with the cleavage police. I'm just saying. Oh, my God. So we started off with Pat Yo last night. We had Katie B. And those two ladies, I mean, you just go, oh, my God. I think we can go now. But then we wake up this morning. We get Mari. We get Ella. I mean, oh, my God. And so here I stand. Anyway, you know, a little bit about me is I have a lot of gals that get to come to my house, or I get to have a lot of gals that come to my house. I like to think of myself as kind of a hostess, you know, from Texas and all that. And so a gal came into my house, and I said, would you like some coffee? And she said, well, yes, I would. And I said, do you take anything to put in your coffee? And she goes, yes, I do. What do you have? I said, well, I have half and half. I have almond milk. I have whole milk. I have almond creamer. I have hazelnut creamer. I have vanilla creamer. Anything else? Well, do you have any sweetener with that? Well, I have stevia. I have honey. I have sugar and rum. I have Splenda. I have sweet and low. I have all this stuff. Now, what the story I tell myself is that I'm a hostess, right? That ain't for y'all. That's all about me. That's because I have such a fear of commitment that I might wake up tomorrow and I don't know what I'm going to want. But God, don't put me in a box, okay? Okay? I need choices. I need options. I'm just saying. So, you know, my mother was a pianist and my father was a rocket scientist. He really was a rocket scientist. And he worked for NASA for 37 years. So he really was a rocket scientist. And a laugh a minute, nothing like a mathematician physics major that just really, ha, anyway, but they were good people. They were good people and they loved me. And they tried to give me everything that they knew how to do. And the trouble was not what they were saying. It was in my inability to hear. Right? It was because I have this disease of perception that Clancy likes to talk about, and I have a disease of separation. Right? I have got to figure out a way I'm going to get away from you. And my alcoholism today wants me to get away from you so that I can drink. That's the only way I'm going to be able to drink. I've got to be alone. Right? But what does it look like? You know what? My childhood looked like a lot of childhoods. There was nothing sinister about it. Right? So my childhood doesn't make me an alcoholic. I managed to be able to drink myself to a state where I weighed 89 pounds. Yeah. I was hot. I'm just you know, and I was listening to Ellen and I came in with two emotions. That bone crushing hurt and that absolute rage. And that was the full range. That was the full range. And I remember those charts. I needed one of those too. You know, and what my alcoholism had taken me to was that every day looked like the same. You know, and every morning and every night was filled with these promises to myself and maybe to some other person that tomorrow was going to be different. Right? That tomorrow was going to be different. Tomorrow I was going to get up. I was going to take care of the children. I was going to clean the house. I was going to take the shower. I was going to brush my teeth. And then 10 o'clock would roll around, 10 a.m. would roll around, and today looked just like yesterday. And I did that over and over and over. I stopped a million times. I stopped drinking a million times, and I started drinking a million and one. And at this point, you know, I did things like I drank while I was pregnant. Not one time, two times, right? Now, my father was a mathematician and a physicist, and my mother was, you know, quite educated herself. And they taught me moral and philosophical convictions. I had values. And believe me, drinking while pregnant was not one of them. And so I had two children absolutely terrified. Because I had, of course, I skipped the part about the husband. But I, like a couple of us in here, maybe it's just me, I met a guy and about 4 weeks later we decided we were going to get married. Because that's what you do, right? As you do. And so we had to plan a wedding, so that took a while. But so 4, 5, 6 months later we were married. And I always like to say, they have the warning labels on alcohol. But if it weren't for that, so that if you get pregnant, you know, you don't want to be drinking while you're pregnant, so they put the warning labels on there. And I say, you know, if it weren't for alcohol, none of us would have gotten pregnant in the first place. So I marry this man and I get pregnant and I have these children and I cannot function. All I have is hurt and all I have is that rage. And I am neglectful to my children. I don't answer the phone when my parents call. I can't leave the house except to go to the liquor store, and which my children are calling the lollipop store. Because where they're so often, they're giving out candy to my children. There's a proud moment, isn't it? Yeah. So, I became violent, you know, and And what it looked like, my rage or my hurt would end up looking like I just broke a lot of stuff. I broke a lot of stuff. And I love to throw skillets and break windows. And the coup d'etat is when you throw the skillet through the window. Wow! And, yes, I'm telling you, it takes practice. And you know what? I had a brother who loved me very, very much. And he'd just bring over a pane of glass, you know, didn't say anything. He just fixed the window, you know. And I lived like this for what seemed like an eternity. What seemed like an eternity. And I hated myself more and more and more and more. And I didn't understand anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anyone who got sober, because anyone in my world who got sober disappeared. Because I was that playground and plaything you couldn't hang out with. Right? So I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. And I certainly didn't think, because I like to think, that what I was drinking had anything to do with how I was feeling. I didn't connect those dots. I couldn't. That didn't make sense. I just drank more. Right? And so what ended up happening, of course, as so many of us do, I was sleep deprived. I was malnourished. I lived like a vampire. You know? And I gotta tell you, when you're living like a vampire, it's really hard to take care of two small children. It's just, you know, because they want stuff like breakfast. Yeah. They want their diaper changed. Yeah, they do. They really want your attention. And my God, I just didn't have it to give. And so every day I woke up and broke my own heart. Not to mention what I did to them. Right? So, you know, we talk about moments of clarity where, like, all of a sudden the lights come on and we go, well, maybe my life is in the crapper and maybe I could do it differently. And what happened for me was that I had many, many moments. Like, I had lots of people coming to me, most particularly my mother, saying, there's something seriously wrong with you. You know, what is going on? And I would say, I got this. I'm good. Meanwhile, I'm just wasting away, bodily, mentally, spiritually, right? So as mothers do, or as my mother did anyway, she rounded up the cavalry. She rounded up the posse. And it's the old living room meeting, right? Who's written a letter? Who's written a letter? Who's had a living room meeting? Oh, come on. There's something seriously wrong with you, and we have a solution. Ram. Now, the way they got me is they said, you know what, we'd like you to go to a treatment center. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's going to be, I want you to pack like you're going on a cruise. Well, I don't know about you, I was so tired. I was so tired, I needed a rest, and a cruise sounded fabulous to me. After all I'm doing, it's hard work being me, hard. Now, what had happened is my best friend at the time, who liked to drink like me, she had gotten sober, and I was like, I wonder where she went. Well, I heard she's going to that AAA thing. Look. Who does that? But somehow my mother, and I love this, somehow my mother knew intuitively, something at work, maybe I realize I know only a little, something intuitively came to my mother and said, call her. Call Janice. Ask her what to do about me. Well, Janice knew what to do, because you had told her. Because you had taught her what to do when that hand reaches out. So Janice is at that living room meeting too. God love her. And I said, well, I'll go to treatment all right. But I've got terms. I want her to take me. I want her to fly halfway across the country. Because it had to be very dramatic, you know. Couldn't just go down the road to treatment. No. You know, I had to fly halfway across the country. And so I said, I will go, but she has to go with me. And she looked me dead in the eye and said, okay, I will. Well, now I'm in a real pickle, aren't I? Well, she and I get on that plane, and here's the part that chokes me up every time I think about it. She had 21 days sober. How about that? And she did it. And she got on that plane, and she flew with a drunk. She was held hostage in a fuselage of an airplane with a drunk. And you know how we do. I'm crying 1 minute, laughing 1 minute, furious the next minute, calling him all kind of names the next minute, and fighting with the flight attendants. As you do. Oh my God. Fighting with the flight attendants because they're not pouring the booze fast enough. Now, right about 20 minutes of touchdown, I turn to her and I say, hey, I have a great idea. She's like, uh-huh. I say, let's check into a hotel tonight, and I'll go to treatment in the morning. Oh, hell no. And upon touchdown, she handed me to you. Because there was somebody there. That's back when people could actually greet you at the gate. And so there was a man who greeted us at the gate. And then Janice and this guy like hugged each other. And I was like, okay, that's really weird. This is taking a nasty turn really fast. Not going to try to hug me, is he? So I got to go to treatment as a 21-day treatment, and really what it is was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always like to say, I got my $17,000 big book. That's what it was back then, $17,000. And I'm so grateful for that. You know what I mean? And they were able to sit on me long enough to get the alcohol and all of alcohol's little friends that keep you up all night out of my system. And they introduced me to the steps. And they got me to do an inventory. Now, I did my first inventory in treatment, as a lot of you do if you've gone to treatment at all. And what had happened for me is I did the very best I could. I was earnest. Boy, and I was writing and, you know, come on, because I didn't want to drink. And you told me if I did these silly little steps, I wouldn't have to drink anymore. And not only that, I wouldn't have to feel the way I'd been feeling ever, ever again. Not ever. I would not have to feel the way I felt that night I walked into detox ever again. And I got to tell you, I was willing to do anything to not do that. So I did my first inventory. I left out gigantic chunks of it, of stuff I had done. But there was no room for it. You know what I'm saying? So it just, there's only so much space. And only so much I could take in and take out at one time. But what this inventory was, they this place had they would bring old people to come listen to your inventory. God love them. And my inventory was really more of a confession, right? All the really horrible things I did. And the woman listened to me, and she didn't tell me anything. You know, she didn't offer me anything for my consideration. She didn't point out anything to me or anything. She just kind of sat there like a toad, which is fine. You know, because after all, she was sitting through the great American novel. You know, and, you know, kind of the prototype of the first audio book, I think. Chapter 7. But I got to tell you, what I had done was make a list of my grosser handicaps. Right? And I had made a good beginning. And I immediately followed that inventory with another inventory because I was able to, you know, this stuff comes to the surface. Wow! I'm able to get it out. And guess what happens? More dead bodies float to the surface. Wow! And I got to get rid of those too. And that's what I love about this journey through the steps. I keep bodies keep floating up and I keep getting rid of them. But I immediately followed that inventory with another inventory with a sponsor who actually did give me some ideas about what it was I'm looking for in this inventory. Why I'm really doing it. Is there some reason other than you just won't drink again? Which was reason enough for me on the very first one, I got to tell you. But the commissions, the things I had done in the past, mostly while I was boozing, although they were grotesque and humiliating, right? I don't think I understood causes and conditions, so therefore I had no real sense of my character defects or any of my shortcomings. Just didn't. You know? And this isn't to say that my sponsor wasn't saying these things. I think she probably was. I just didn't have the capacity to hear it. I have a hearing problem. You know, you can be talking. I just asked my husband. He can say something, and then sometimes he just looks at me and goes, "What'd you hear me say? I heard you call me fat." No, you didn't. But what I did come away with was, and how I lived my life for quite some time in AA, and more particularly in untreated alcoholism, was that I have had some transgressions, right, in my past, right? But now that I wasn't drinking anymore, these things weren't going to be happening anymore. So I was good to go. By golly, I'd been cured. Ding. So where does that leave me is that I'm still justified in being angry, right? That it's okay to gossip if it's true. Right?
I'm just saying.
That sarcasm isn't hurtful to anybody. I'm just being funny, right? That's okay to flirt with someone I'm not married to and that my husband doesn't know about, as long as I call it just being good friends. Oh, I like how that went completely dead. That it's okay to ignore that still suffering alcoholic over there because she dresses like a floozy and can't stay sober for more than a week or two. Oh, no, you cannot. I was thinking I'd been healed by working steps 1 through 5 and a little smattering of 8 and 9. That I'd do some quiet time on the toilet in the morning, as you do, because, you know, I have kids and I'm busy. And, you know, who has time for prayer and meditation? My kids are little, busy. I go to a few meetings, right? I'm doing the discipline, and I call that the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12. No, I didn't. I don't have language like the disciplines of 10, 11, and 12, you know? I might have been sponsoring a few gals, but the reason I'm sponsoring a few gals is because I want you to think I'm awesome. Right? There was nothing ever really long-term in that sponsorship stuff. Steps 6 and 7 had no meat for me. After all, come on. There are a couple of paragraphs in the big book, so really, how important could they really be? And I fought them for a long time. I just didn't get it. Now, this doesn't mean that people weren't saying it. I just didn't hear it, right? But what I did do is I hung on to the fellowship. Oh, man, I like the fellowship. Hugging, kissing, going to the movies, bowling, right? Pizza, more eating, a lot more eating. Let's go eat. And I rested on my laurels. You know, I rested on my laurels. I didn't sponsor anybody. What I was practicing was a program based on the abstinence of alcohol, and I thought that was enough. I thought I was doing it. And so I did this meeting-based sobriety for a little while, right? I just go to meetings, and I thought that was going to fix me. I really did, because I'd go to a meeting, I'd sit down and go, "Oh, I feel so much better. Gotta go." Right? And then what I also did was I had this desperate desire to make up for lost time. Any moms out there feel like they had to make up for lost time when they got sober? Yes, I see lots of nodding. So what does that look like for me? Well, I'm president of the PTA, don't you know? Of course I am. I'm going to be president of the PTA. I'm going to be baseball mom. I'm going to teach Sunday school. I'm going to be homeroom mother. I mean, you name it. But by God, I'm going to be there for those children. My kids are going, you again? Really? Spirit of rotation mean anything to you?
No!
You know, and you think, well, isn't she a giver? No. I'm baseball mom so that my son gets to play first base. Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, he's not riding the pine. Oh, no, 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 no. I'm homeroom mother, so my kid gets the best teachers. Right? Not leaving anything to chance. I'm running the PTA, so everybody knows who I am at that school. They better not cross me. Better not cross me. You know, so, really? Am I giving? Oh, no. I'm a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind. But I also need some me time, don't you know? Because, you know, I'm the only one that's going to take care of me. Don't you? So I play a lot of tennis. And I get really good at tennis. I get really tan. You know, I'm that annoying chick who wears a tennis skirt to the grocery store. Yeah, no. Great legs, though. Great legs. So I'm completely selfish and self-centered because this is the root of my problem. I had never gotten down to the root of my problem. I had gotten to the list of my grosser handicaps. But I had not gotten down to the root of my problem. Hadn't gotten down to causes and conditions. And what I know today, in this minute, is that I suffer from spiritual narcolepsy. Yes, indeed. I fall asleep all the time. I love naps. Just take a little nap. Just a little spiritual nap. Whoop, back again. And I look at the bedevilments. The bedevilments is my benchmark on page 52. And I ask myself those questions all the time. Am I having trouble with personal relationships? Well, if I just told the guy at the coffee shop that he can kiss my... I'm probably having trouble with personal relationships. You know? If all I do is roll my eyes when my boss walks in... Oh, her again. Maybe I'm having trouble. Maybe. Just maybe. Where am I in those bedevilments? It's a great question. So needless to say, what does my home life look like? And I love when you're talking about married to a man I never should have been married to in the first place. That's not to say my children's father isn't a good man. He is a good man. We just weren't a good fit. Right? And we were abusive to one another, unkind to each other. There were no spiritual principles being practiced in our home. In fact, we were having a lot of hall sex. We pass each other in the hall and go, screw you. So I'm going to fix this because that's all I have is I'm going to fix this. I'm going to try harder. I'm going to be better. I'm going to make this different. Because I'm an extreme example of self will run riot, though she usually doesn't think so. So my best solution is this, hey, I've got an idea. I want another baby. As you do, come on. So I have another baby. Well, you know, it's always the perfect storm, isn't it? Because God loves me so much, He's going to figure out some way to get me in there. And He's going to try the easy way first. I always hear people say, well, I got to be hit on the head before, you know, I do any growing or I go toward God or any of that kind of stuff. Well, that's just because it's about the 98th time He's had to hit me. Most of the time He's going, hey, boo. Hey. Sugar pie. Honey bunch. Hey.
Hey!
Before five. Kabong! Well, you didn't have to be so rough about it. Well, what happens for me is my mother dies. She gets the cancer and she's dead in 90 days. And I have no tools. None. Nothing. No spiritual program, no spiritual principles, no nothing to deal with this. Now, I have my spiritual life is literally in the toilet because that's where I'm praying. And, right? And so, and I am hopping mad. I am so mad. And this is all God's fault. After all, God, I've gotten sober. I have taken good care of these children. I have tried to be, I am teaching Sunday school for God's sake. And this is the thanks I get. And this is, that's what my spiritual life looked like. That's what it felt like to be me in that time. And so I am, I am in untreated alcoholism. Oh my God, am I in untreated alcoholism. See, up to this point, I wasn't going to any kind of meetings. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have any of that stuff. You know, I was just in untreated alcoholism and in pure self-will run riot. And, and blaming God for the woes of my condition as I continued to play tennis every day. My mother dies, and I have this really good friend, and his name is Cecil. And I'm talking to him about it. He's really cute, so I'm talking to him a lot because we're just really good friends. And I'm talking to him a lot. And the thing is, I'm believing I'm healed. The only thing that's different is I'm not drinking. That's it. That's the only change that's happened for me. And so I'm not drinking. And I'm complaining to Cecil about how bad I've got it, and he looks at me and he says, because he has 5 months sober at this point, and he says, "Well, have you prayed about it?" Oh, I said, "No. Why don't you pray about it?" And he looks at me and he says, "Okay, I will." Well, you got nothing to that, right? Okay then, fine, see if I care. Pray then, stupid. But I gotta tell you, so he's got 5 months sober, he's going to a lot of meetings. He's insane, but he's going to a lot of meetings. And so if he's going to meetings, why by golly, meetings got a lot more interesting for me. So now I'm going to a lot of meetings, especially the ones he's going to. In fact, only the one he's going to. And it isn't long because even though I have moral and philosophical convictions galore and I have a value system, it isn't long before I step out of that because I don't have any other choice. And so the next thing you know, I'm having an affair with Cecil. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good times. Now, I'm going to fast forward a little bit through that story because Cecil and I have now been together 20 years. And he is indeed the love of my life. And there's a whole lot more to that story. Anyway, I do know that, I do believe and I rely on this, that God loves me so much, he will send the cavalry. He sent me Katie Parker. Yeah. She's an untreated alcoholism. I'm an untreated alcoholism. We're going to this totally quirky little meeting that no one's ever seen a big book in, ever. Just saying. And so she comes up to me and she goes, she is a mess. Let me tell you, she is a mess. And she comes up to me and she says, "Hey, can you sponsor me?" Of course I can. Who wouldn't want what I have? So we get started on this journey through the steps. Now, I don't know anything. I got no depth. I got no weight. But I got a lot of pride and I got a whole bunch of ego. Right? Thank God. It's not always defective. So she's coming to me and we're sitting on my carport and she is crying and we are smoking and she is crying and we are smoking and she's needing some answers and I don't have any. But I remember that there's this thing called a big book. It comes to me like a vision. And I'm thinking, there might be something to that. So I get me one. And I start reading it. And I got to stay one page in front of her. One page in front of her. Oh, yeah. And so then I remembered something else. There's this whole thing called sponsor. That if I am a sponsor, I probably need a sponsor. Now, you know, I have the spirit commitment thing. Ooh. So, anyway, and the way I get my sponsor is I go up, I hear this woman, and she talks really, really impressively in a meeting, in an AA meeting. And I go, I think I'll ask for her take on step one, because we're on step one. And, I start to go across the room. I say, I'm going to ask her about step one. And you know, you get that voice that sounds kind of like, I don't know, a baseball announcer. And he says, why don't you ask her about all 12? Now that's a commitment. But I did. You know, I did. By the time I got across the room, it's coming out of my mouth going, can you answer me? And thank God, because this woman took the time to show me the big one, right? She didn't just tell me about it. She showed it to me. She showed me how selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. She had me lay my experience up against that book. And then when I was able to do that, there was no denying it. Not for me. She showed me that I must disregard the other man entirely. Entirely. And that I must resolutely look for my own mistakes. This is going to be a lot of work, I can tell. But here's the thing. I'm in so much trouble, I don't even know I'm in trouble. You know that spot? I know you know that spot, right? And I actually said to her at one time, I'm not going to drink or anything. And she looked me dead in the eye, and thank God she did. And she says, what makes you so sure? Did you get your power back? Oh, going to be a lot more work than I thought it was. But you know, the truth is, people who aren't in trouble, they never make that statement. People who are in the middle of this deal, they never say, well, I'm not going to drink or anything. It just doesn't come up. So I began to hear AA, and I began to hear the 12 steps, and I began to work the 12 steps in a way that I'd never seen or heard before. And it changed my life. You know, beautifully enough, I got a ton of sponsees. Shout out to Canada, hey, and Austin, Texas, and some of the gals from the Primary Purpose. Yes, and you know, I believe that I don't get sponsees because I'm all wise and all that. I get sponsees because God knows I need every single one. And I too like to talk about the seduction of long-term sobriety. I've been doing this thing for a while, right? And I got a massive ego. It's a massive, you know, you got to have an ego to be able to stand up here. You have to have an ego to go into an AA meeting and say, my name is Marty and I am an alcoholic. But what I like to do, the seduction of long-term sobriety for me today is, you're not really inventory worthy. Think about it. Yeah, I'm not going to write it on you. I don't even like you. Why would I write inventory on you? How about this one? If I've heard 10 inventories, I don't have to write my own. Oh, yeah. Anything to keep me from doing the work. And if I'm not doing my own work, it becomes academic. The 12 steps become academic and theoretical. Spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. So what happens for me in my life? Even though I'm working with Katie Parker and I'm working with, you know, several other people, half of Travis County, and what happens? And I've got the love of my life, and you know, we were engaged for 5 years, and we dated for 2. I mean, you know, we tried to set the. He used to say, "I just want to set this thing up for success." I'm like, "Oh, for God's sake!" And we were trying to do everything the right way. And what's happening for me is I find myself in the kitchen, nose to nose with my husband, Cecil, having hall sex. And I'm screaming at him, screw you. Yeah. And I love this man with all my heart. And I don't want to blow this thing up. But I can't not. Because I am so full of old ideas and character defects that on my own, the very best I can do is blow this thing up. That's all I got. And at this time, I had about 15 or 16 years sober. Oh, yeah. Very proud of that. But through the 158,912 inventories I have done on my husband, I get to see these old ideas and character defects in black and white. I get to look at my causes and conditions, my old ideas about commitment, about marriage, about children, about stepchildren, about men, about women. And I discovered I tried to hold on to these old ideas. And the result was, you better believe it, until I let go absolutely. Now, had any of these ideas ever become objectionable to me, or was I still convinced I was right? I love to be right, right? After having done a fearless and moral inventory and discussed it with another human being and God, and that human being who can point out my character defects, who can resolutely show me my own mistakes and the harms I've done, not the harms you've done. I'm good with that. I don't need any help on the harms you've done, believe me. And how I also continue to make those mistakes and inflict that harm. There's more work to be done on that inventory. With that inventory. Starting with, finally, the sixth step. What is the sixth step? We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I like to think of those as my co-missions. What I have actually done. We've emphasized willingness. And what is the definition of willingness? The state of being prepared to do something. It means I haven't done anything. I'm just prepared to do it. I'm willing. Am I in action? No, but I'm willing. We've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? What's the definition of objectionable? I love this. I looked it up just the other day. Arousing distaste or opposition. Unpleasant or offensive. Mm-hmm. But here's the deal. It must be objectionable to me. Whether or not it's unpleasant or offensive to you is irrelevant. It gets me nowhere. It keeps me stuck. Well, it gets me thinking you need to be different. It gets me thinking that you're a jerk. It gets me thinking that you're an idiot. Right? So I get to look at these things. You know, I thought sarcasm was just good stuff for a long time. And, and after all, I'm entitled to be sarcastic, you idiot. And this is how I'm showing up, and I can't imagine why people are not just cozying right on up to that. I have this unbearable need to show you how right I am all the time on everything. You know? And I have to weigh in with my opinion on every single issue. As if you need to know what I'm thinking about everything all the time. All the time. And with that, I get to finish every sentence under my breath with, "You dumbass." Well, I didn't say it out loud. Right? He didn't hear me. So funny, my husband complains of being hard of hearing, and he is indeed hard of hearing. But if I go, "You dumbass," he can hear me from about 4,000 feet. "What'd you say?" "Nothing." So what does all this stuff look like? I got to tell you, my husband and I moved out to the country about a year ago. And we moved on to his family's place. This is a ranch. I know, isn't that funny? I live on a ranch in Texas. That sounds like a cartoon, doesn't it? So we moved out to the ranch in Texas. My husband's family has owned this place since 1937. He is the third Mr. Ruby to live on this ranch. And it's a wonderful place. It has great meaning for him and for me. And so this is how I showed up last October. So I want to decorate it. You know, I want it to look fabulous. I want to make it my own, right? And so I love plants. I love gardening. I love all this stuff. I love, you know, all that. Southern living. Love it. So I get all these potted plants, and I'm going to put them by my door, the entry door, right? And it looks great. It looks really pretty. Right? And so my husband comes out and he goes, yeah, you can't put pots by the door. I went, what? Yeah, you can't put, as my husband said, you can't put pot by the door. Why not? Well, you're going to put that pot by the door, a snake's going to get in that pot, and I got a snake by the door. Really? Remember, 1937, his family's been out there. I've been out there 15 minutes. So, I keep those pots by the door. And my sister-in-law comes over the next day and she goes, yeah, you can't put pots by the door. Like, what? She goes, you put pots by the door, next thing you know, you got a snake in the pot, and now you got a snake by the door. My mind says, really? So someone had a snake by the door in 1949, and I can't put a pot by the door with my Boston ferns? This is ridiculous. But I practice spiritual principles, don't you know? So I move those potted plants away from the door, but I move in the ceramic pumpkins. Technically, not pots. Technically, not a pot. Right? 48 hours later, guess what's in my pumpkin? A coral snake. Yes, let's get serious. Not a little garden snake. Oh, no, that's not what we're talking about. This is Texas. Everything bites, sticks, stings, or burns. It's a 28-inch coral snake. My dog has it. My husband's out there trying to kill it with a shovel. Talk about a cartoon. So, and I'm in the kitchen going, oh, my God. Way more than my husband could ever possibly know about that ranch. I'm the smartest gal in the room. Well, maybe not Boston ferns, but looky here. Because I'm defiant. And I'm arrogant. Right? And what I have found that often, if not always, defiance goes hand in hand with arrogance. Sometimes we think, well, I'm defiant. By God, that makes me bold. No, it doesn't. I got to promptly make amends for that. Like, as soon as I went, oh my God, that was all me. Clearly, no one was injured in this incident. Thank God. They could have been killed. Literally, could have been killed. The good news about all of this, if it's me, I have a solution. Right? There is a solution. If it's you, the problem is you, one of us has to die. If the problem is me, then I, with God's help, can get free. Okay? So can he now take them all, every single one of them? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us. Be honest about what I'm clinging to. I may enjoy actually being a know-it-all, and frankly, I do. I may enjoy being the smartest gal in the room. Well, it doesn't suck, you know? But really, in the truth of the matter, aren't I just taking up all the space in the room? And am I just sucking out all the air in the room? Really, when I'm doing that? So, in other words, am I cooperating with God in these steps? I am a character. Not everything about me is defective. Nowhere in my book does it tell me I work on my character defects. I can't just try harder to be nicer. I can't. If I'm doing that, I am white-knuckling it. Right? Just like with drinking. I will be nice right up until I can't. And then I will be sarcastic, and I will need to show you how right I am, and I will be defiant and arrogant and a jerk. That's what I am on my own. Right? Brings me to the seventh step. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I like to think of this in terms of my omissions, the things I don't do. Anyone ever lie by omission? Of course you have, right? Remember, I'm not working on my character defects. I am asking God to do that they be removed, but I must cooperate. It doesn't say, I humbly told God, I'm just going to try harder. I'm just saying. So I have a daughter-in-law, because my son and daughter-in-law, before they decided to have a baby when they were 18, they have gotten married. They now have two children. They've been married for 6 years. It's not a bad thing. It was just a little sudden for me. And she's a lovely woman. And my son is crazy about her. And she's crazy about him. And they've made a sweet little family. Do I agree with how they've done it? Not 100%. But guess what? It ain't any of my business. Right? But what I want to do is I want to accuse this daughter-in-law of being divisive in our family. By not letting me be the best grandma in the whole wide world. Right? And that it's her fault that I'm not. My inventory, when I did the inventory on her, because she is definitely inventory worthy, finally. What it showed me is that I'm the one who's divisive. That I'm the one that doesn't seem to make enough time for her and my son's family. And then I'll resent them when they haven't included me. Right? That I'm so busy it's hard to pin me down, except at my own convenience. And the truth is, I want to be grandma on my terms. Selfish much? But then I get my feelings hurt when she doesn't turn to me and rely on me in my terms. Sensitive much? I'm afraid she doesn't like me or says bad things about me. How much do I like her? And am I saying bad things about her? Is that what love looks like? Is that what you have taught me that love looks like? Does she know I like her? Does she know I love her? That I'm so arrogant and self-centered that I should supersede anyone in her life? What about her own mom and dad? Should I be more important to her than they are? That's crazy. I've done this inventory. And I know today, with the help of another human being, that I'm the one who's divisive. That I'm the one who's selfish and arrogant. Ouch. You know? So when I went to make amends to her, I said, she's in the house and she's got the children with her and we're sitting and we're talking and visiting, and this is what goes on in my head. I should tell her, I should set up an appointment with her to make the amends. She's sitting in my living room. I did make the amends. But I take this to God in 6 and 7 because this relationship and the state it's in and the state I'm in has become objectionable to me. It has aroused distaste and it has become unpleasant. And I don't believe that's who God's asking me to be today. I don't see me practicing spiritual principles in this relationship at all. But without God's help, even at 27 years sobriety, this is the best I get on my own. This is the kind of trouble I get into on my own. Without God's help. Once again, spiritual narcolepsy. Going right to sleep in that relationship. Once again, the good news is, if it's me, there's a solution. If it's not, you're going to have to go. But I can become different. I can become transformed. But I must cooperate this. I have to become available to her and my son. I have to go to the baseball games and the Halloween parties and the birthday parties. Oh, yes, let's go to another 2-year-old birthday party. I have to be the one who picks them up from school in an emergency. have them spend the night at my house? Do I want this relationship or don't I? Be honest about it. For me, I do. For me, I do. And I also have to let them raise those children in the way they see fit. And always, always, always treat all of them with dignity, respect, and kindness, and love. Go into that seven-step prayer. God, I'm now willing that you shed all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. I thought it said, for the longest time, remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my happiness and getting good stuff. I thought this was the part where God is going to make me happy. Ding, you're happy. That I would indeed be rendered white as snow. With no effort on my part, I'd finally get that pony I'd always been wanting. This has not been my experience at all. My experience is that I must cooperate, that I must indeed, if I want gossip to be removed, I must stop gossiping. If I want to stop being considered a jerk at work and someone difficult to work with, I have to stop being a jerk and someone difficult to work with. It's not complicated, but for me it seems like rocket science. If I want to stop being a know-it-all, I have to stop weighing in with my opinions on every single issue. And as Pat said so beautifully, I don't know the date these things were removed, but I know they happened. Right? Rebellion does dog my every step. So, I had a heart attack a couple years ago. That was fun. Just a little one. Just small. But after that heart attack, what I found myself doing is going to my husband and saying, you know, because I had a little crisis around it, you know, kind of mortality, face, death, and face. So what do you want to do with the rest of your life? It could be really short, you know, after all. So I asked my husband, you know, I don't know what I want to do with my life. Okay, you want me to tell a different story? So I said, I don't know what I want to do with my life, but I don't think I want to work anymore. And he says, so quit. I don't want to quit. So don't. But I don't want to work. I mean, I don't want to keep working. Then quit. Well, it just wouldn't make financial sense for me to quit. Then don't. What I discovered through the inventory once again was that what I wanted him to do was make me not afraid. And I just won't stop trying to make Cecil make the world a different place for me until I go to the source that is all power. Right? That surrendering to God, making me useful to him and his fellows. It's not my definition of useful. It's God's definition of useful. I realize I know only a little. Only a little. What if character defects were our greatest treasure? What if I stopped trying to get rid of it and asking God to remove it as he sees fit? Everything in us wants to be rid of it, to be perfected, so that you think I'm awesome. Grace is sufficient for you, but it's not something you can understand, and it's not something you can will to have. It just comes. To be in too big a hurry to get over our difficulties is a mistake, because you don't know how valuable they are from God's perspective. Without them, you might never, ever, without them, I might never, ever be transformed as deeply and as thoroughly as I believe he has done for me. I'd probably go on thinking that I was the one that had transformed me, that had taken away my difficulties, that it made me nicer, more inclusive, and less arrogant. There's nothing humble in that. Nothing. And I wouldn't need God at all. I could go back to being that extreme example of self-will run riot. But I've already tried a godless life. It was horrible. I truly can't answer the question of how free do I want to be. And as an alcoholic in good standing, I want it all. For once, that desire to have more, 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 more works in my favor. See, God doesn't waste anything on me. Not one thing. He's now taken that part of my character that was so defective, the one that wants more, 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 and He's turned it into an asset. Now I want more honesty, more freedom, more peace, more God. And this is the way I join the human race, if not for the very first time, in my case. I get to be a part of something so magnificent and so exquisite that it takes my breath away every single day. I really am commencing to stand shoulder to shoulder with my fellows. I came in here on October the 19th of 1989, and I thought this was the darkest day of my entire life. But my perception was all wrong. All wrong. This was, in fact, the beginning of a brand new life. I gotta tell you, I wanted God to be in as big a hurry as I was to transform me. Mr. Man, I've got a plan. Follow it, please. Dear Santa Claus. I couldn't understand it when he wasn't in as big a hurry as I was. I mean, I'm looking for the fairy dust. Ting. But today I realize I know only a little. I know only a little. Thank God. From know-it-all to knowing only a little. It's huge for me. But this is where I find true relief in 6 and 7. The relief from self-reliance. The relief from being a moral failure. As Katie said, self does not fix self. It cannot fix self. But I have a solution for that today. This is where I really start getting to see God's work. And then that gaining that momentum and that transformative process. Because I'm learning how to get out of His way in 6 and 7. And this is a dangerous, dangerous place to balk. There are some incredible women coming up after me who have some amazing things to say about how and why we don't balk. I want to thank you all for having me here this weekend. It's been a ball.